Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the XX podcast for Thursday, April 18th. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX. I am joined in the DC studio today by Dan Coyce, a senior editor at Slate. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
And we are joined in New York. Are you trying to be extra manly in your hello? You had me at hello.
Yep.
And we're joined in New York by Noreen Malone of the New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hi. I don't think I can top that greeting.
I think you have to be extra feminine in your greeting. Hi.
Hi, Hannah.
Hello. Anyway, our three topics today are, first, the House of Horrors abortion clinic in Philadelphia and why the media failed to cover it. Second, a new anti-masturbation movement. Makes me laugh just saying it. And third, the dismal state of American childcare. So, dead children and masturbation always go well together.
So okay. I was trying to bring some levity into things, but thanks for...
Yeah, thanks for bringing it low right away. Yeah. Okay, let's start with the horrible abortion story. So Kermit Gosnell is a doctor who operated what's come to be known as the House of Horrors abortion clinic in Philadelphia. The clinic went unchecked for a good 2 decades until 2009 when a woman finally died on his table. And investigators also became suspicious that he was giving out prescriptions to OxyContin and other drugs. So what they found there was pretty horrifying, disgusting conditions. The flea-infested cat is something that comes up a lot in the description. And then also they discovered in talking to his staff that he was a man who had perfected techniques for killing fetuses born after 24 weeks – in some cases, pretty much alive. He and his staff have been charged with several counts of murder. But then this opened up a bigger media and culture story of why did the liberal media fail to report on this? Is it because they were uncomfortable with a story that might make abortion clinics look bad? So I don't think you get the full horrors of this story until you read the grand jury report, which describes in great detail what they found when they went to this clinic. So I'm going to ask you guys to fess up. Did either of you read the grand jury report?
I read part of it, and it turned my stomach and made me deeply sad.
Yes.
I determined from reading the stories about it that if I read the grand jury report, I would be unhappy for the rest of my life. So no, I didn't.
You're not wrong. It's very vividly written. Whoever was the lawyer behind this had a lot of passion for this case, not incorrectly.
Now, something that struck me, you know, a grand jury report has a specific purpose in mind, which is to rile up the grand jury, right? And it is clearly horrifying under any circumstances. But, you know, one thing in the grand jury report is that a lot of the women who came into the clinic were young. They were like a 14-year-old that he was performing an abortion on, a 17-year-old he was performing an abortion on. I mean, there were some older women. The woman who died was in her 40s and was an immigrant. But you did get the sense of people who just kind of didn't know what they were doing and stumbled onto his clinic. I don't know if that's good or bad. I just felt the need to mention that.
Well, and also a lot of low-income women and minority women. I think that's one reason maybe why this case hasn't gotten quite as much attention as other cases have.
Yeah, although there was an amazing moment where they say, you know, if a white woman came in from the suburbs, she would get different treatment. You know, he had all sorts of phrases like, we have to be careful with this one, or, you know, it's just the way of the world. Like, with this one, we have to treat her differently. Whereas with the really uncomfortable abortions, he would do them on Sundays with just his wife present if the baby was really big. But is there a sense, you know, when we've had the murder of abortionists before who were second trimester abortionists, we portrayed them as heroes in a way. You know, these were people who were, you know, operating in the shadows of the law, in states where abortion was not legal. There's no way we can portray this guy this way, right?
Oh, my God, no.
That's what makes this uncomfortable.
No.
Right. That's what makes this case uncomfortable for everybody.
Right. And what makes it super extra double uncomfortable is that there is, like, we're always trying to find that thin line between the heroes and the monsters, right? And it's important to both sides where that line is and how you define that line. And a case like this is so painful to deal with for people who have spent their lives fighting for abortion rights because it illustrates to a huge number of Americans that that line is weird and uncomfortable to think about and talk about.
Yeah, so we draw the line at 24 weeks, right? That's legal. There's a whole thing in the grand jury report about how he would fudge the sonograms of anyone who's had a sonogram. I am one such person. They're eminently fudgeable.
Right.
It's like they just seem like bullshit, right? It's like, how big is the baby? I don't know.
They seem like magic.
They seem like magic, okay?
Yes.
But it's like, but I'm not talking about the initial sonogram with the heartbeat. That's a magic moment. I'm talking about the ones that are measuring, because I'm a diabetic, I had a million sonograms measuring the size of my baby. You know, is the baby going to be too big? And they're drawing kind of circles around a blob, right?
Right.
And it's like, where do you draw the circle around the blob? So he would train, these were not doctors, but the people on his staff, none of whom were licensed, to draw the circle on the blob slightly smaller such that it would come up on 24.5 weeks, right? So 24 weeks is legal. 24.5 weeks is just a tiny bit illegal. And yet it produced this horrible situation of, you know, almost live babies who he then had to induce labor and they were born alive, right? So there is like a real question for the pro-choice movement here about what's the, you know, so really the difference is between 24 weeks and 24.5 weeks. It's the conversation we always have about how as the technology advances, you know, one has to reckon more seriously with what one is doing.
Well, and also we should clarify a little bit that he wasn't just fudging it to 24.5 weeks. He told one woman at least that she was at 21 weeks and she was in fact at 29 weeks, which is really far along.
Right.
And that woman actually ended up having her baby. He initiated a procedure and then she freaked out and said, I don't want to do this. And he said that she had to because she'd already paid him. And so she left and had her baby at a hospital.
So in walks the conservative media, right?
Right.
This was a USA Today columnist who was echoed by Ross Douthat, picked up by a lot of conservative media asking, you know, here you've got an unbelievably gruesome crime story. It taps into, you know, a live cultural debate, and yet the media did not really cover it. You know, there was like a couple of AP stories in the New York Times here and there, but, you know, by and large, the media did not cover this story. So, Dan, is this a legitimate complaint on the part of the conservative media that we failed to cover this story?
It's legitimate in the sense that it does seem like it was not covered as much as you would think a totally insane, horrible story like this would be covered. Though it should be pointed out as well that it's not like the conservative media was in the vanguard of reporting on the story. They were in the vanguard of reporting that people weren't reporting on this story.
Right.
I have sort of, since this case broke for me anyways, which I didn't know anything about it really until the past week, I have been trying to figure out why wasn't this on MSNBC like every day? Why wasn't it on Fox News like every day?
Or like, Nancy Grace or like
right,
someone.
Like yeah. It's or why didn't Ross Douthat or someone else, even like a conservative op-ed columnist, why didn't they grab this 2 years ago and just run with it? Because you could – like a good columnist could make hay out of this case for years.
Right.
And
right.
So it's really shocking to me that no one on either side has grabbed onto this and made more of it. And one question that I had is it just too horrible? Is that why? Have we in fact discovered the threshold at which the media distaste for a really awful story overwhelms their desire for page views? Or is it that there are ways that you can spin this story as being really uncomfortable for either side of the abortion debate, right? It's obviously uncomfortable for pro-choice people because as we said, it sort of lays bare the weirdness of this dividing line. But it's also really uncomfortable for pro-life people because it is clear evidence that the more you restrict legal and safe abortion, the more unsafe and gross abortion gets. And so did no one make hay out of it because it's just hard to make hay out of?
I have a much more mundane guess as to why the story didn't explode. Is it just has to do with media resources, that the normal way such a story gets big is that you have a local newspaper that covers it in the day-to-day coverage of their crime stories. I myself was just covering a crime story in Ohio, and it seemed to me completely whimsical, like in the initial part of the story, it got some, sort of New York Times AP coverage, and then it kind of faded away. So they're just media resources for that kind of local coverage are so erratic that if you don't have a reporter who's covering it regularly, and then say like the New York Times doesn't have someone posted in Philadelphia, or the Washington Post, who used to have people posted all over the country picking up on these stories, like it's just harder for stories to get through that require on the ground, being in the courtroom every day.
Is the Philly paper covering this every day?
They weren't. No.
No, but they are now.
They are now.
But they weren't like when the trial started? That seems insane.
Right.
But in 2011, it did sort of break through. There was some thoughtful coverage on Slate, for instance, from Will Salatan. Slate is different from the New York Times, right? But like there were items there. It just, didn't quite blow up. And I think the reason has to do with what Dan articulated, which is that the reason that the clinic was not inspected had to do with politics, right? When a Democratic administration took over, they wanted to loosen the strictures on inspecting clinics because the more regulations you put onto abortion, right, the closer you get, the theory goes, to having it be fully regulated, right? That's an awful political reason, right? And so for both sides, it became a political football in a really ugly way that had really gruesome real-world consequences. And I think that's something that people didn't want to fully grapple with.
Yeah, but not in any overt political way. It just speaks to the permanently dysfunctional state of our discussion on abortion, right? The inability to normalize abortion as a part of healthcare leads to situations like this. This doesn't, the pro-choice side is equally culpable here because, as you said, Noreen, they just allergic. Like the word regulation, they immediately think of a slippery slope coming out of, Virginia, Kansas, Alabama, Mississippi, name your state of, ever choking regulations on abortion clinics. So they won't let any regulation or oversight happen at all. So the idea that you had a health department, and Will Salatan in his story gets into this. There were definitely complaints that came into Planned Parenthood and various other pro-choice groups of, women coming and dropping hints about this clinic, what happened there, what happened to their friend there, and nobody followed through with it.
Well, and to the different Pennsylvania state government boards and bureaus that got complaints that just shuffle them off onto other departments in hopes of not having to deal with them because through a mixture of just sheer bureaucratic shittiness and an actual definitive declaration within the administration that regulating abortion clinics was not a good idea at this point in time.
Right.
I have to say I hate the media angle on this. Like, I know that's why we're talking about it and mm-hmm. why – and it is making us sort of deeply considerate. I wish we were talking more about – the biological facts of it, right? Which, as much as it is a horror story, it makes you think about, as you said, what is the difference between 24 weeks and 24.5 weeks? And, you know, can you really have a hard and fast stance in either direction on something like this? And
well, I think like technology and medical care has made the debate increasingly complicated. We often talk about how sonograms have made, you know, the abortion debate more complicated because so early on you can get a heartbeat and you can see the baby. And, you know, if you're forced to have a sonogram before you have an abortion, then that makes women even more uncomfortable. But the debate at the other end is that we are able to save fetuses at increasingly early ages, right? Like, so that makes the difference between 24, 26, 27, you know, these things become really difficult. Like, maybe soon they will have, you know, there's an idea right now. There's somebody working on it's the old Shulamit Firestone feminist dream, but somebody's working on it for medical reasons, which is to have babies live outside the womb, basically. And if that happens, you know, then you're in real trouble here because all these babies are savable. And so then the abortion debate becomes ever more complicated. So what are you supposed to do, Noreen? Like, what's the right answer here? Like, test every baby for viability and then draw the line? Kind of, how do you do it, you know?
Personally, I think yes. Like, I think that is the point where, for me, and I know I'm veering into, like, really uncomfortable territory here, but I think that
but
for me—
you're a Catholic and so—
I am a Catholic. No, I mean, but yeah, I think, like, if something can survive, that is a life. And I think that to not consider that deeply and fully, like, as a pro-choice person, that upsets me if it's a movement that doesn't think in those terms.
Right.
But from a practical standpoint, though, then you are guaranteeing that abortions will be probably two, maybe three times as expensive as they are now and way more difficult to get if there's a whole new battery of tests that need to be run. And so then when do you set the limit? Do you move the limit back and say, well, at 18 weeks, you don't have to run those tests? Or do you consider the fact that, yes, at some point a 24-week fetus is going to be viable, but only for the extremely wealthy?
Right. I mean, I'm not the person who has a full arsenal of information on this. You know, there are people who have thought a lot more in depth about the practicalities of this. Again, I want to point you to two Will Salatin pieces from 2011. One of them, he sort of takes on pro-choice absolutists. And that's sort of what I'm pushing back against. And then what he does, which is really smart and really good, he then sort of takes all of the arguments against him, like explaining why you need, you know, late-term abortions and what kind of women are seeking them. And he considers them carefully and agrees with some of those arguments and disagrees with others. And I think, you know, wherever you stand on it, that's worth reading. He is someone who is far better informed than I am on this issue.
You know, for years and years, there's been an actual national consensus on abortion, actually, if you poll people, which Gallup has done, which is that Americans believe in the right to first-term abortion. Even people who call themselves pro-life actually believe in the right to first-term abortion. So it seems like that's the only safe ground we have. And beyond that, everything gets complicated, particularly as technology advances, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dan, you want the last word?
Right. But then you end up with people like the women who ended up in Kermit Gosnell's clinic who it takes them like 5 months to save up enough money for even a cheap, shitty abortion.
Right.
Well, so the answer, we come back to it, is that healthcare is fucked and we still fucked and we need to fix it.
Right. That abortion should become a normalized part of healthcare and so that they don't need to save up that money and that would solve this problem, you know? And honestly, like a 17-year-old comes into a normal, regulated doctor's clinic who has a baby, you know, who is pregnant with a 30-week-old fetus, then the recommendation is that you deliver the fetus and give it up for adoption.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Ugh. Great. We solved it. Good job, guys.
I'm really depressed. Okay. Let's move on to our second topic, which is the anti-masturbation movement. But before we do that, we would like to thank our loyal regular sponsor, which is Audible.com. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet. And you can listen to it on practically any device, including the one you're listening to us on right now. For XX listeners who aren't Audible members, there's always a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but XX. This week, I'm going to recommend Louis C.K.'s appearances on the Opie and Anthony show, which I recently discovered when I was looking something up, are on audible.com. And particularly, there's the one which we'll link to where he talks about his defense of Daniel Tosh's rape jokes and the various funny things that Louis C.K. says about what it's like to be a man these days and what's wrong with men. Okay, let's move to our second topic. Hands off.
What's wrong with men is that they're masturbating too often.
They're masturbating too often.
Yep.
I'm going to ask you very personal questions, Stan, since you're a resident man.
I'm prepared.
Okay, good. So hands off. An article in New York Magazine profiles a group of men who are quitting masturbation. As the article says, not because it's shameful or forever associated with adolescence, I might add hairy palms, but because on a fundamental, even chemical level, it's draining their true potential. This is known as FAP. That was new to me. Did you know FAP was an internet slang for whacking off?
I did. Yes. No. As the article notes, it is onomatopoetic internet slang.
FAP. Yes. I don't read Reddit often enough, clearly. And the men are known as FAPstronauts.
That was a new and horrible neologism. Yeah.
So they're a group of people who they're sort of meditators or they're excessive porn watchers or computer nerds. It's sort of a collection of people. And the tricky part is they're not using it to be gentler in that tantric way. You know, I want to be more peaceful, but to be more manly. Like one guy gives a testimony where he talks about how his laying off masturbation allows him to pick up women and kick ass at his job interview. So it's kind of a complicated movement. It all started with a TED Talk. Dan, do you want to give us a little bit of a history of where this this anti-masturbatory movement came from?
Well, it does seem to have been spun out by New York Magazine from a Reddit subthread that has, you know, maybe 100 guys on it. I don't know.
We've resorted to that before, the Reddit subthread story. Right.
But so the movement seems to be about in the TED Talk that the article
Phillips
refers
Lombardo,
to.
Yes.
Yes. It was not only about not masturbating, and in fact, not even primarily about not masturbating, but was more about men's relationship to internet porn and, as this doctor refers to, IPED, internet porn-related erectile dysfunction, the theory being that if you just watch a ton of internet porn and theoretically then also masturbate, that it just skews your interactions with normal human women while also draining you, I guess, of your vital fluids.
Literally and figuratively, yes. Draining of your vital fluids. Yes. So this is a TED Talk by Phillip Zimbardo, who's quite famous psychology professor. He was actually my psychology professor at Stanford, but he was the conductor of the famous Stanford Prison Experiment, among other things. And this talk was called The Demise of Guys, which I have listened to and read his paper. It's mildly convincing. I mean, he does it basically by interviewing people, and he does have a theory of young men today being desensitized, basically, that the reason they're desensitized is because they need variety. Like they expect things from watching porn and variety. But the jump to masturbation is interesting to me because it gets into a larger cultural thing, which Louis C.K. does talk about all the time, which is man's animal nature. Like we're in this moment where we're starting to recognize, I've gotten a few pitches about this in Double X, like the fact that, you know, men are beasts and that they have to learn to tame their inner beast. And how can they do that? I mean, I don't know about the anti-masturbation movement. It doesn't seem that viable to me for obvious reasons. Nonetheless, it does seem part of a larger cultural moment of like men are beasts and what are we going to do about it?
I do think that the anti-masturbation movement is really interesting, though, in that the response to it is so different than it would have been even like 10 years ago, which is that basically at this point, medical science has come down on the issue in saying you could basically masturbate as much as you want all the time and it's not a problem. It's no big deal. Maybe you will have some chafing, but that's it.
On your hand or on your penis?
Right, either. Yeah. I mean, it depends how enthusiastic you are, but right. Yeah.
And at least one fertility doctor said he encourages his male patients to go at it as much as possible to sort of, I guess, get the juices flowing.
Right. Sperm begets sperm. And mm-hmm. The more you extrude, the more you produce.
Mm-hmm. Is that true? I mean, does any of this
sure.
Does any of this have any basis in science at all? Like either side have any basis in science?
Yes. I mean, yes. Scientific research basically comes down on the notion that there's no determined link between any level of masturbation and any sexual dysfunction at all.
I mean, it's not like a new...
Don't be so smug.
I mean, masturbation has been considered a sin by a lot of people for a long time, right? So that was like one anti-masturbation thread for like centuries and centuries and centuries. This is self-help, but it's not like a moralistic self-help, right?
Well,
like,
it's always like, moralistic, though. It's moralistic in the same way that someone who is like, oh, I only drink raw kale juice.
Right. No, I thought it was moralistic in the particular way that Americans are moralistic right now, which is it's like that article saying you should sleep less, right? It's not so that we can be relaxed or meditative. It's that we can function more effectively in the workplace and in our personal lives. It's all about, you know, it's self-help, right? So that was very surprising to me, that kind of pickup artist twist at the end of that guy's testimony. It's not at all what I expected him to say, that, you know, not masturbating would allow him to, like, get it on with a girl. I think it was, like, literally in an airplane bathroom, something he'd never – it's like a nerd, you know, finally being able to, like, maximize his manliness. I was surprised by that. You know, it's never about, like, peace and goodwill in this world or morality. It's about, you know, being a better you.
I was not totally surprised, because 10 years ago when I was a high school senior, the boys on my swim team, before, like, for a month or something before, like, the biggest meet of the year, they all took a pledge to not masturbate so they could be, you know, they could be, like, just ready to go and just unleash all of their manly strength into the water. Yeah, it was really funny.
Did they just announce this to the school? Was it on the morning announcements? Did they present flyers?
No, I mean, they just, you know, we were, this was, like, discussed. Like, the girls didn't shave their legs, and, you know, so that we could shave them right before the big meet, and the guys were just, like, not masturbating, and I don't think a lot of them were having sex, so they were just saving their energy.
What's the equivalence between the hairy legs?
Oh, you're just trying to, like, do everything you can, right? Like, swimmers, like, sort of game everything as much as they can, and because leg hair is, like, drag, right? And then when you shave it, there's less drag in the water. Like, there's actual evidence for that.
Right.
But masturbation was just, like, I think it was kind of a bonding thing. I don't know what they were doing.
Right,
there,
but my concern with them is that they would be so full of sperm that it would be a hydrodynamic drag. Like, weren't they concerned about that at all, that their enormous blue balls would cause problems in the water?
I'll have to call up one and ask him.
Like, I can imagine them just sinking to the bottom of the pool. Crotch first.
17-year-old boys. I'm, like, mostly all I have in my mind is, like, the smell of the locker room after the meeting.
Oh, God.
Hannah, stop it. This is not a smell-o-vision podcast.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Blue Balls. Like, I have to stop it.
No, but okay. Also, I think, like, Olympic athletes do that too. Like, some of them, they all have their sort of approaches, you know, to, and some of them sort of abstain from any sexual activity, including masturbation, and some of them take the, like, the opposite approach, and they, you know, their virility will be maximized by just, like, sleeping with anyone. A lot of this, I think, is, like, just emotional, right?
That's what's surprising to me. I thought when people tell athletes, you know, don't get distracted by your girlfriend, right? Like, that comes up in every show trope about teenage boy athletes. I thought they meant, like, emotional distraction. I didn't think they meant literal, like, chemical, you know, potency.
I think teenage boys maybe are just literal, and they
teenage boys are only literal, yeah. But I mean, one thing that was really interesting about the response to this piece, so right now, NoFap, the Reddit thread, is up in arms about this story, as has every internet subculture ever been about every story ever written about them in a magazine. But in this case, many of the NoFap Redditors are upset because they feel like the article mischaracterized their movement, which is in fact sort of about not masturbating, but really is sort of about an addiction to internet porn. That's what a lot of the chatter is about. That's what a lot of the discussion on the thread is about. That's what the TED Talks that they're responding to are about, and to some great degree. And so it is interesting to me from a journalism standpoint why the article ended up being written this way. And my pet theory is that the piece was originally meant to be pegged to Joseph Gordon-Levitt's movie Don John, formerly titled Don John's Addiction, which is all about a bro who watches too much internet porn and can't relate to women as a result, until a kindly older feminist played by Julianne Moore teaches him to get in touch with his feminine side and break away from his porn addiction. But then at some point, like, they couldn't get access, or they couldn't get Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the cover, or they didn't want to wait till October when the movie's coming out, so they just did the piece.
Interesting.
But I agree with you that that's a more interesting story, that the porn addiction.
Right. Well, literally, New York Magazine did that exact story less than 2 years ago.
Yeah, and they've done different versions of that story. They've done it from the perspective of the high school, those sort of young Latina girls, you know, whose boyfriends were asking them to pose in various porn poses, and they did it from the perspective of a guy in his 20s who was writing about how the porn addiction was ruining his sex life because the girls weren't doing it for him. So they've been on the porn tip.
Right.
And other people have too. GQ's done it. I mean, The Atlantic's done it.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of interested in that question. The masturbation question doesn't seem real, but I am genuinely interested in the question of what, you know, the watching of porn does to the sexual awakening of young children. I'm sure it's not as bad – not young children, but teenagers. I'm sure it's not as bad as we think, but I am curious about what it looks like.
It doesn't seem like it's doing anything good to them. That's for sure. Whereas I wish that they – like, it is weird that I am now, like, nostalgic for a day when it was just shitty penthouses that teenage boys were masturbating to. Like, that seems like a sexual fantasia, teaching them wondrous things about the female body as opposed to just, like, whacking it to internet porn. Which seems
so should we admire these fapstronauts? What's their proper term? Like, for seeing a problem in their lives and trying to combat it in some way?
In theory, yes. Though in practice, I bet they're all still doing it.
Yeah, and I also, like, I wasn't that one guy, you know, with the sex in the back. He doesn't strike me as someone who's having, you know, great respect for women and has come to a different place in his life and was, you know, seducing and romancing. He was, like, having sex in the airplane bathroom. So I wasn't that moved by that. You know, you mentioned the sort of Playboy penthouse. So Thy Neighbor's Wife, that Gay Talese is one of my favorite books, and in the entire first chapter, it's about, you know, the American sexual awakening, and the entire first chapter is about a young teenage boy trying to get away from his parents, like at the breakfast or dinner table, so that he can masturbate to a magazine. So I really want somebody to kind of rewrite that scene, that chapter today. You know, like, what
he
is that teenage boy?
He just needs to get to his phone.
He just needs to get to his phone. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Anyway.
Right. That young teenage boy is now just sitting at the breakfast table with his family, but with porn on his phone while they're not looking. And then he's like, excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom.
Ugh. That's so all depressing.
Right. Enough. Stop. I have two sons.
Right.
I
you're right.
Move
it's surly teenage boys masturbating have now lost all their romance.
Right. So the solution is to buy your sons a phone with no internet access.
No, just buy them a stack of Playboys, for God's sake.
Here, son. Okay.
How are we going to transition?
I don't know. I'm trying hard. We're going to transition now by transitioning. 3, 2, 1. Childcare. Here we go. Okay. Serious matters. So Jonathan Cohn has a very convincing story in the New Republic about the hell that is American daycare. He takes one painful-to-read case of a home-run daycare gone terribly awry, but then he expands it to the larger circumstances in American daycare, single moms who have to work because welfare has made it anathema to stay home, but who have nothing to do with their children. And then the broader question of, you know, would fixing daycare fix American feminism? So, Noreen, you want to start by just talking about a little bit about the case that he describes, and then we can move quickly on to the larger questions about daycare.
Yeah, it's worth reading this piece. The story, again, is sort of an outlying horror story. It's a young woman. Single mom who could only she'd sent her first child to a nice daycare center. She couldn't afford with her second child to send the girl there, and so she found a young woman, this woman Jessica Tata, who she ran a daycare out of her home. She had a minor criminal record. She in high school had been convicted of arson, I believe, but she was reformed and she took a lot of pride in her daycare. And so this woman left her daughter there. And one day she turns on the news and there was a fire in a daycare, and it was the daycare where she had left her daughter, and her daughter died along with other children. And it turned out later that this woman, Jessica Tata, was, you know, like doing things like taking the older children in the daycare to McDonald's while the other children slept, or just like leaving them alone in the house. And she had not been in the house when the fire started. It was a grease fire or something. It was like oil in a pan. Anyway, she was not there, and the fire started, and the children died. And so that is an unusual story, right? Like, thank God that does not happen all that often. But one sort of terrifying stat in this story is that accidents and things like this are 7 times more likely to happen in a home daycare situation, whether it's in your own home or in a situation like this one where you're dropping your child off at someone else's house rather than, you know, a larger daycare center where things are regulated. And that is scary.
So then to extend that point, that these home daycare centers are typically and traditionally the only options available for lower income women, especially single moms, who need to find a place to put their kids in order for them to be able to go to work, right? And the right. Specifically, the mom in this story had had her kids in more institutional daycare centers, but she fell behind on those payments, and then there wasn't space available in those centers. And so the only place she could find was at this home daycare center, which she found because, like, her mom ran into this woman at Target, which horribly was then the exact place that that woman was when the fire started in her house and all those kids died.
Yeah. And why is this story important? Yes, this story is atypical, but the situation of the central woman described in the story is absolutely typical, not just typical, but fast expanding. I mean, this is the woman who represents a lot of the women I write about in my book, very much so because she's becoming a nurse. So she's entering the healthcare field, which is extremely typical for poor / working class women who are trying to make it and enter the middle class. Extremely typical because there's no dad mentioned in the picture and because she's raising these two kids on her own. Extremely typical because she's going to school, right? This is working class and middle American class womanhood today and ever expanding. You know, mm-hmm. the alarming cultural change in America is the number of children born to single mothers, which we have surpassed 50%. This is America now, the story that he describes. And also, you know, this is America in the post-welfare reform era. So you have a situation in which it's no longer acceptable for poor women for any period of their child's lives to stay at home. That's not really an option anymore. That's not something our government can support. So, you know, we've got in government welfare reform, we've got the government putting people into work but not really providing any source of daycare for them. And we've got workplaces which are accepting the tremendous influx of women into the workforce but not really providing any daycare options or accounting for that. So basically you have tons of women who are screwed, right? And increasingly so. You know, there's sort of an upper class version of the story, which is like why women can't have it all. Why is daycare so expensive? Jessica Gross has written posts for us about this, like the constant calculation of like, does my freelance salary like make up for what I'm paying my nanny? Like there is an upper class version of that. And then there's just kind of a big American middle class, working class version of it, both of which are important and true. So that's why I think Jonathan's story is really important. Like, has anybody figured this out? I mean, France comes up, right? Dan, what was that story or either of you about France?
Yeah, well, so France has to some extent figured it out in that they just basically have a wondrous socialist childcare system that works really well for a lot of French families. We ran a piece last summer that my friend Claire Lundberg wrote, who is an American who now lives in Paris with her husband. They both work. And even though they are pretty solidly middle class, they have a very affordable set of options that the French government helps out with. And lower class people in France and poorer families have amazing options, functionally free childcare beginning at 3 months, where children can go into a government-run daycare called a creche. They're usually open from 7:30 in the morning till like 8 at night, and the hourly rate is on a sliding scale. Then later, between 3 and 6, there's a preschool called École Maternelle. It runs 4 days a week. It's not mandatory, but because it is so cheap and so well run, 95% of children of the proper ages in France attend these things because, for example, my friend Claire in this piece discloses all of her financial information. It's totally fascinating that she gets 40 hours of childcare a week right now for her child. After government rebates, she ends up spending about $500 a month, which is like ridiculously affordable and way more affordable than any childcare that I ever got anywhere in the United States.
And it also normalizes childcare, right? It's like a little bit like the abortion debate we have. It puts it under standard government regulation. It makes it a norm. It also takes away the kind of mommy wars around it because it's just something that women do. Like your kid reaches a certain age, they go into childcare, you go back to work. It's just a completely normal situation that doesn't require any judgment or debate.
Right. And they're also very high quality because there are very strict regulations and they're run by the government and staffed by trained early childhood educators.
And I have an argument cribbed from John Cohn for everyone, you know, for whom strict regulation and like the French are sort of dirty words, you know. we're really making the socialist arguments here. But let's say you're someone on the more rightward leaning side of things. It's actually economically beneficial to the United States to have better healthcare. As John lays out, every dollar that society invests, you get between $7 and $12 in benefits, according to this guy, James Heckman, who has won a Nobel Prize for his work. Those children then cost the state less in the long run for things like trips to the ER or special education, incarceration, unemployment benefits. So those are all costs that theoretically we could sort of get out in front of by having better early childhood care. And there's just a wealth of social science to support that. I'm not just sort of making that up. So, you know, if you want to like invest in the country's future, it's a really smart sort of bottom line aware thing to do.
Now, unfortunately, this is an American blind spot. We did have a big child care debate during the Nixon era, which I looked into at one point, and it immediately became a culture war issue. The idea of the state in any way being responsible to take care of young children sets conservatives on edge, right? It immediately becomes a debate about who's responsible for the child, the mother, or the state. So that's where this debate would go. But somehow I have hope that the debate might be won, not immediately, partly because Obama makes it a priority, but also partly because the women in conservative states, should they turn their new financial power into political empowerment, will start demanding it, right? It's generally women in red states who find themselves in these situations more even than women in blue states. So so that's my small hope about why American daycare can become a priority.
I don't have that small hope. I mean, it doesn't seem to me like we have made any progress, and it doesn't seem to me like I hear anything from anyone that suggests we will. I mean, even the proposals that are on the table now from the Obama administration seem like tiny, tiny baby steps that 4 years from now won't have had like any real effect.
Is there any way to make this like sort of a sexy issue? Like, it's truly a feminist issue, and we don't talk about it as much as we should. We sort of end a lot of conversations by being like, well, if there were better childcare, but that's just sort of like a cop out, right? Like, we're not really talking about it in a real way, and we're using it at the tail end of conversations about like Sheryl Sandberg, for instance. Like, is there a way that people will get more interested in talking about it?
Well, my solution is to make it a less sexy issue. In other words, don't go in the Sheryl Sandberg or the culture war direction. It's not really a feminist issue because France has by no means solved its feminist problem or its problem of women in the workplace. They've
right.
just solved the problem of childcare. So I'd rather just deal with it as a practical issue. And the way Obama has done it is by working school backwards. In other words, pre-K eligibility, making it seem like just an education issue, which I think is a much safer road to go than the words, you know, childcare or infant, which taps into the kind of Nixonian culture war issues. So that seems to me a better bet. I also appreciate that John Cohen did not make this a Sheryl Sandberg, Anne-Marie Slaughter debate, but made it a debate about the poor and working class, which is in fact the giant and growing problem in America. That's all I got.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I read a book that's about 10 years old. last week I was on a little vacation and I read a ton, but this was the best thing I read. So I'm just going to go ahead and recommend it. Notes on a Scandal by Zoe Heller.
Oh, yeah. Why do you laugh?
That's a great book.
All right. I think it's really good. It's masterfully written. I haven't seen the movie, but as is usual, I can't imagine the movie being as good as the book because she really sort of inhabits her narrator's head. The narrator is this sort of sad older woman who's obsessed with a younger colleague who is then in turn obsessed with a young man at the school who she has an affair with. And it's just really precisely and well written.
I agree.
The movie does have Judi Dench, though, being like horrifying. So it's got that going for it.
Yes. She plays it well. I am going to recommend something I need listeners' help on. It's the Anthony Weiner story in the New York Times Magazine, which we considered talking about today, decided not to. I want our listeners to read it because I was completely bought his transformation, and I've never done that with a male politician before.
You did?
Oh, my God.
I know.
We should have talked about this. I have so many thoughts. Are you kidding?
Maybe next week.
Yeah,
he's a monster.
Well, I think that I was totally duped by the opening scene in which he was like such a daddy and, you know, he had become a bet. Okay, we should have talked about
it. Yeah, that wasn't staged or anything.
All right, but I bought it and I think I might be an idiot, which is what my husband said. So clearly you guys would have said I was an idiot too. But I want our listeners to tell me if I was a total idiot in buying.
Well, he's not going anywhere. We should talk about his mayoral candidacy maybe.
Okay, we can bring it back up with his mayoral candidacy. Apparently he was, you know, without even declaring that he was going to run, the New York Times mentioned today that he was second. He came up second in a list of candidates in a random poll. So it clearly it worked on more people than me. Stop laughing at me. Go ahead, Dan.
My recommendation is pumpkin seeds. I've been roasting pumpkin seeds a lot. So it turns out, so I was like, so here was the story. So we made a jack-o'-lantern last fall, right? Like everyone does. And then I took a bunch of the pumpkin seeds and I roasted them and they were fucking delicious. And I was like, well, why can't I eat these all the time? But if you buy roasted pumpkin seeds at the store in a bag, they're awful. Like they were roasted like 7 years ago and then they sat in a vat and then they put them in a bag and then that bag sat on the shelf of the Harris Teeter for like a year and then you bought them. Mm-hmm. And they're bad. But I was like, so why can't I just – I don't want to – gut a pumpkin every time I want pumpkin seeds, but I want to have pumpkin seeds. But it turns out because the internet is amazing, you can just buy a 3-pound bag of raw pumpkin seeds for $12 on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And then, so if you take a, just like a bunch of them, like a couple of cups of them, and you soak them in water for a little bit so they more accurately represent what a pumpkin seed is like when it comes out of a pumpkin. And then you put it on a cookie sheet with like a little bit of olive oil, and then you roast it at 300 degrees for 40 minutes, and then you add like some garam masala or some curry or some cinnamon sugar, and you shake it all up, and then you eat it. It is delicious, and everyone should do it.
And dress up like a vampire while you're doing it.
That's correct. And then, but whatever you do, don't masturbate.
All right, we're ending it there. Thank you to Mike Vuolo for engineering this podcast.
He did not masturbate once.
He did not masturbate once during the whole hour. That's some restraint.
Yep.
This might have been our dirtiest podcast ever.
And like grimmest, dirtiest, most depressing, everything. Yeah. We're just down in the gutter.
Yep.
Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. As always, please log on to our XX Facebook page. Tell us what you want us to talk about in the next couple of weeks.
That was Andy's voice you heard at the beginning of the podcast telling you about the explicit language that this podcast contains.
Definitely has. Don't masturbate when you stop listening to this podcast. For Dan Coyce and Noreen Malone, I'm Hannah Rosen. We'll talk to you next time.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.